Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Blaser from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. For today's cast, I'm going to be talking to the developer of the currently early access game, Destiny. And I'm pretty sure I mispronounced it. I'm going to let him hopefully say it better in a few minutes. Yeah. But they are a South Korean studio, Fake Dice, and my guest tonight is the community manager there, who actually got in touch with me regarding the game. I've played a little bit of it, and it's definitely coming along to be a very interesting mix of CCG play and a traditional board game. And as you may know, for those of you who read Game Wisdom, I've wrote several major posts on the topics of collectible card game design and the balance and fine-tuning. But let's welcome our guest from Fake Dice. Please welcome Mike Lee.
How are you guys? I'm grateful to be here.
It's great to have you on, Mike, and thanks so much for getting in touch with me a few weeks ago regarding Destiny. I played a little bit of it. It's been a very busy time here. I've been working with a collaborator for the site, and for those of you who are regular viewers to the YouTube channel, I've been doing my best to sort of rejigger it and try to make it more appealing to everyone.
Yeah. Yes. I totally understand. You're a busy man, so it's sometimes like I have a trouble, you know, playing other indie games. Although I should. So yeah, it's totally understandable. But just one thing I want to point out is that it's a Destiny. Yeah, so it's like dice plus, you know, destiny thing, you know, so
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I will hopefully get practice with it over the course of this cast.
Yeah, a lot of people make mistake with the name, so
All right, so to get things going, Mike, since this is your first time on the cast, could you talk a little bit about Fake Dice and sort of the background of your studio?
Sure. So you won my whole life or just like gaming career?
Gaming is good.
So I got into the gaming industry in 2008, and I got a job at a company called Bluesight. Mm-hmm. And they're the developer of, I'm not sure you know, but the Kingdom Under Fire franchise.
Yeah.
And I was a business development manager. Not manager, like a junior. I worked there maybe four years there. But I was really frustrated that the game, they were working on Kingdom Under Fire 2, but they started developing in like 2007, and the game still hasn't come out, you know, and it's 2016. So I was really frustrated. So I quit the job in 2012, and then I kind of had a question about, you know, staying in the gaming industry, because you know, it's an industry for young people, you know, so I was kind of worried, like, when I get, when I become like a 50 or 60, you know, will I still be in this business? So, I actually went to Hong Kong and I worked for this import and export company, mm-hmm. and there I realized how fun it is to work in the gaming industry. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like it, you know. It's so dynamic, and it's just the other. Office works, it's so boring, mm-hmm. in my opinion. So I missed the game industry, so I came back to Korea, and luckily I got a job at this company called Codebrush. And Codebrush, they made a game called Archblade. It's a free-to-play game. It's actually available on Steam right now. But after we launched it, we didn't do very well financially, so called it a quit, and we stopped the development, and like half of the people left, you know, so maybe like seven people left, and the people stayed remained. We opened a new studio, and that's Fake Dice. And Fake Dice is currently working on Dicetiny, and we have right now 6 people, and two programmers, one artist, and one game designer, and actually two game designers and me. And I'm a community manager and marketing manager. And since I'm the only one who speaks English at a reasonable level, I handle like pretty much all the stuff like that involves speaking English, like localization and stuff. And I also contribute some ideas, like the character names and stuff. So, yeah, I guess that's about it. So, you want me to explain about the game too?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, I think, Mike.
Okay, yeah. So I guess that's about it for me, yeah.
Okay. Now, when did you guys actually start working on Dicetiny?
We were started working on it. Let me see, 2014, late 2015, I guess. No, late 2014. Yeah. So in 2000, the early concept came out like maybe September. No. Mid 2015. And then we launched our Kickstarter campaign in October 2014. So we did a Kickstarter, and our goal was about like $30,000, and we were really close to reaching the goal, but we actually canceled it because we found like external investor, and publisher, so we canceled it, and the relationship didn't go very well, so we kind of parted our ways, and we're now all independent. So we've been working on it like about 2 years, I guess.
All right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting to talk about how a lot of the studios these days have been going to Kickstarter and going to early access with their designs and ideas. Now, for the rest of the team at Fake Dice, did they have like experience with like other games before they started making Dicetiny, or was Dicetiny like their first game kind of idea?
Yeah, so the most of our team members, I guess all of us are came from the our previous company, called Brush Games, and we developed a game called Archblade. It's basically a multiplayer fighting game with like maybe a little bit of elements of MOBA, and it's a completely different game, but yeah, as I mentioned, financially it didn't do very well, so yeah, we had to stop the development. Yeah.
Okay. I guess one question that I wanted to ask you about, Mike, it's one of the questions I've been asking a lot more of my guests as I've been reaching out more to the international space. And I do want to ask you about, I guess, sort of the state of the game industry in South Korea. Now, for people listening to this cast, we all know that South Korea has really become like the mecca for esports. It's where StarCraft really grew in popularity over the last decade and so. But in terms of actual game development and studios making games there, I know probably I haven't heard too much. I'm sure my audience hasn't. So, if you wouldn't mind, Mike, could you tell us a little bit about how game studios are doing in South Korea these days?
Nowadays, it used to be like maybe in early maybe 2000, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it was all about like MMOs in Korea. We have like big studios in Korea, like Nexon or NCSoft, like those guys. We call them like a big N, big Ns, because they all start with N. So yeah, they used to be really big, but Nowadays, like all of them, they move on to mobile games. So if you read like a news, gaming news in Korea nowadays, like they always talk about this mobile games, RPG games. They all look the same in my opinion. And like nowadays, what's really popular nowadays in Korea is like auto control. It's like you turn it on and the character just fight on its own. You don't have to. All you have to do is just press like skills time to time. That's really big. There are tons of games like that nowadays in Korea, and you see so many like copycats. And so yeah, like I would say nowadays 90% of the developers in Korea right now is working on mobile games. And even like if you look at indies, Korean indie developers, there are mobile games. Like if you think about indie games in the West, you think about like Steam or GOG or something like that. But in Korea, it's all mobile games. Like, but nowadays, like there has been a few successful games on Steam. I'm not sure you know, but there's a game called Tree of Life. It's a survivor MMO. And they released this news that they earned like $100,000 in their first week or something. And after that news came out, like you see many like Korean developers started developing Steam on they try develop games for Steam. So you see more and more like Korean developers trying to break into Steam. But yeah, mobile is the big thing, that's what everyone's talking about and working on. Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting what you just said, Mike, about sort of like the decline of the like MMO market side of things with companies like Nexon and NCSoft. Because we've seen that a lot in the US over like the last decade. Like right now, it's still pretty much World of Warcraft as the king of the genre. A lot of the other MMOs have either completely disappeared or they've minimized their scope and their projects. I know like there's a few still going on right now, but the market itself has definitely dried up compared to, I would say, 10, 15 years ago. Now, with the mobile side of things, that's another thing that has definitely been growing a lot more in popularity. As you were just saying, there's definitely a case sometimes of copycats or the developers basically cloning other games. We see that a lot in the United States as well. What's interesting is I spoke with a developer from India, Rahul Sagal. I hope I didn't butcher his name either.
Yeah, he's the guy who was on the show like 2 weeks ago, right? Yes, I heard his episode, yeah.
And he was also talking about like the state of mobile development and about how they're also running into that problem with like a lot of developers, a lot of companies trying to push for very low quality mobile games, and how he didn't feel that that market was particularly sustainable. And so from where you're sitting and with what was like going on with like Tree of Life and Destiny, these are obviously PC games with a little bit more meat to them, a little bit more substance. I guess my question for you regarding Destiny then, in terms of like the state of the market, why did you guys decide to make it on the PC versus just making it for like the mobile market?
So we had to like look at our history to explain that. Our previous company, Codebrush Games, we worked on a game called Archblade. And we made this game, and maybe it was an early stage of development. Maybe we had about 30% done, and we were actually looking for a publisher. And we found a few, maybe like three or four, and they looked at our game, and one of the publisher was really interested, so they kind of started sticking their nose into our development. So they said, "Oh, do this, do that, it's popular right now, whatever." But then, like, all of a sudden they saw it's not going to be popular anymore, and they left. So we were really kind of in a way devastated. So we said, oh, screw with it. We're just gonna release this on Steam. So that's how we kind of started our relationship with Steam. So we first launched Archblade and didn't do very well, but that's the platform we're familiar with, right? So that with Destiny, we actually developed it for mobile first. As I mentioned, when we did a Kickstarter, when we canceled it, we found a publisher, and they wanted us to develop it for the mobile, and we did that. But we were doing that, but like we kind of didn't like. We just didn't click. I guess we have a different DNAs. So, we parted our ways, and we said, "Oh, Steam. Maybe Steam is where we should be." And we kind of consider ourselves kind of like outsiders. The kind of games we like are not the games that the average Koreans like. We can't like. We prefer like Western games, on Steam. So let's just re release this on Steam. That's where we feel most comfortable.
And it's funny that you said that, Mike, about finding the audience or finding the market on Steam or the PC compared to mobile. Because again, talking to Raul a few weeks ago with his game, Board of Light, he said pretty much the same thing, that he had a lot of trouble with pitching the game to mobile publishers and the mobile market due to the complexity and sort of trying to make something a little bit more complicated. And he like pretty much again said the same thing when he just finally decided to go on to Steam, it felt like a huge weight was lifted off of his shoulders because he felt that the game was going to do a lot better there. And from my limited time at the moment playing Destiny, I can definitely see that here, like this is a very different design compared to other games. And it looks like the game has been doing well, at least on Steam at the moment. I see you have pretty much like a above average reviews. It's staying at mostly positive at the moment.
Yeah, it's 75%, but it's like it's nowhere near where we hope. Like I think just looking at other games, I think you have to be at least above 80% to be what I would consider like really successful. Because I think in my opinion, people look at the review a lot. I don't know, right? So we have to like just trying to raise that number a little by little, So I and also you mentioned that like mobile development being difficult to break into. The one thing that we really struggled with was like the free-to-play business model. We had never done that. And this publisher suddenly wanted us to include all those features that would sell better. They would make games sell better, and we just could not follow that. So yeah, that was a big problem.
And for those of you listening to this cast who have read previous posts, I'm also not a huge fan of free-to-play mechanics. It's something that I feel that it's very hard to do right, both in the way that the developer can still make money, and that it doesn't seem like they're inhibiting or hurting the player unless they, spend a few bucks here and there. And I think that's another thing about the difference between like a mobile versus a PC fan. Most of my friends and a lot of people I know who play on the PC, we prefer pretty much, the one and done buy. Let me spend, $5, $10, whatever, and then that's it. If you're going to release more content, maybe a few bucks for an expansion, but I want my initial purchase to be the main purchase. I don't want to have to spend $5 and then, get a little pop-up saying spend, 50 cents here, spend $1.25 here, etc.
And that those kind of business model, it requires a lot of thinking. And like when you look at Blizzard or Supercell, they did tons of research, and small indie developers like us, we'd never like come up with a good business, model, because we don't have the resource to do all those research, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And even like major PC developers are still trying to figure out that balance with not just with like microtransactions, but with like DLC additional content along those lines. For instance, like I think a really good example of that would be Paradox Software. Have you heard of that studio, Mike, by the way?
I think I did. What games did they make?
They make a lot of like the grand strategy games, Europa, Universalis, Crusader Kings. They made another big one, Heart of Iron. They make a lot of very high concept strategy games. The games that you can sit and play for hours on end due to their depth and complexity. And their whole business model, I'm sorry, is all about you get the main game and then they do a lot of supplemental content that you can spend, extra money on through DLC and expansions. So they release like character skins for their units or additional songs. And then they have like expansions that add in pretty much new systems into the game. So they've done really well on that side of things, but it's definitely a very specific kind of strategy. Like you really need to do your research and you need to, I think most importantly, you need to properly plan out how you're actually budgeting these things. And that's one of the things that is very hard with the free-to-play or the microtransaction model, was you need to figure out ways to create transactions that are supposed to be, indefinite purchases, 50-cent boosts or dollar skips, stuff like that. And not every game can really work that way, or even be designed along that line without breaking the inherent concept of it.
So I think the when I think about like microtransaction, I think the things you sell should excite the players. It's not something that just focuses on squeezing the money out of the players, you know. Something that should like when a player look at it, oh, they get excited about, you know. I guess like some kind of a skin is a good example or something like that, but yeah, but it's just my opinion, yeah.
And I've been thinking about maybe doing an updated post about that kind of transaction. Because again, I think a lot of people, especially a lot from the PC market, we prefer purchases that give something, a permanent unlock. It's the whole League of Legends model, I think, in a nutshell, with how they have the champions, the premium skins, custom stuff that you put the money down. Yes, it's higher, it's going to cost you more, but then once you buy it, it's yours forever. You don't need to rebuy it, or if you spend the money, there's some free-to-play games that it's a random draw, so you don't know what you're going to get. And I think that may just also be me, like, because I have like no real love of gambling, so I'd rather do those one-time purchases because my luck is always horrible with random stuff.
It's I guess we come from a similar background, kind of older school, concert days. Those who've been who experienced those years, they can never forget the feeling of playing. Just you buy a cartridge or something, and it's yours forever, right? But they always have a problem, understanding the free-to-play model, I think. And speaking of the League of Legend, the Archblade, our previous game I told you about, we kind of follow that business model. And I think you should never follow whatever the business model the bigger, really AAA studios did, because it will probably not work out for you. Like League of Legends, they have tons of users, right? Like the billions of users, and that's why that skin selling skin business model works. But for our previous game, we didn't have enough users. So although we had like a, I think we had over 1 million download, but it was free to play. So, but only like 0.1% or less than 1% people spent money on it. So that's why we did so bad financially. So our mistake was following that business model, you know, the of a really big game studio.
Yeah. I think the other thing to keep in mind with what Riot Games and League of Legends said was, I believe for like the first like year or so, they were pretty much operating at a loss. Like they were still trying to build that community. It took a long time, at least a long time in terms of game development standards, before the game started to turn a profit. And by then, they already had, you know, the millions of users. It had that notoriety to it attached. But I think you made a really good point there, Mike, that for a brand new studio, someone who it's their first game, something that's trying to follow along those footsteps, it's a lot harder because you don't have these same, you know, advantages or the same, I'm sorry, same path that Riot Games had, because they were obviously the like the really one of like the first major multiplayer games, so they had that going for them as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like they did their research, and a small studio like us, you know, we would never do something like that, you know, like, and we kind of, you as you can see, our game got a lot of reference from Hearthstone, and we have six members, and we have different opinions, and some of us, you know, should think that we should, in a way, like, follow their footstep, you know. Kind of borrowing their ideas, and I'm kind of against that. You know, we have six people, so we have different opinions. So, but it's just my opinion. But like, maybe you, like, let's say there's a really a game you enjoyed really a lot. You know, like Hearthstone, for example. And if you're confident that if you can make it more fun by changing something or adding something, you should do it. But like, let's say Hearthstone, or I will put some other elements in there and see what happens. You know, you never know it's going to be fun or not. You know, you have to be sure. You have to experience that. You know, that's what Hearthstone did really well. You know, they look at the magic, and they said, "Oh, if we make it digital and make it more fast-paced, and a lot more animations," you know. Make it a lot more easier for the user to get used to, then it'll be a lot more fun. And they did test a lot of testing, and they actually could see that it was a lot more fun. That's why it was so successful. But our game, to be honest, like sometimes I'm kind of skeptical, but it's just my nature. And it's like we. The first time we came up with idea for our game, we said, "Oh, we should make a roguelike game where game takes place in some kind of board. You know, you keep circling the board, and once you reach the end, you maybe go down, and that's like another dungeon, and you just keep going down. And then one of many of us at the time." Played was playing Hearthstone, and oh, Hearthstone is so fun, you know, it's awesome. Maybe we should add it, you know. But I was like, oh, you don't know whether it's going to be really fun, you know. Anyway, we did that, so I guess our job is to make it as fun as possible. But yeah, we're still trying to, you know, find that you know, right. Spot, you know, like to right, or I can, how can I say this? Like sparker to make it sparker. I guess that's our like job right now, our task right now.
Yeah, and a lot of good points you just said there, Mike, both about Hearthstone and sort of like Blizzard's model. Blizzard's MO, pretty much for like the last. Wow, it's got to be at least going on, well, I could say 14, 15 years at this point, has been looking at what's popular and figuring out, you know, what they can do to improve on that and then make it their own. The whole idea behind World of Warcraft was them basically saying, here's EverQuest, how can we make this better? And as you just said with Hearthstone, it's the same thing with Magic the Gathering. They know that Magic the Gathering is a great game, But they found ways that they could improve or make it more accessible, and at the same time, they made it their own. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, in a matter of speaking, of how Hearthstone has, in like the short, it's been, what, like 2 years, I think, maybe 2-3 years since it first came out, that has become one of their best-selling titles, again, thanks to their ability to really, like, pick apart the design and figure out ways to expand and improve on it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, when you, I guess you must have played the Magic, the digital version. It's horrible in my opinion. Like, I think that's because the people who made the game, come from board game players. They're not like real PC game players. So their ideas are kind of stuck in that brick and mortar, you know, style of game. So I think that's why, you know, and Blizzard looked at it, and oh, we can make it a lot better. So why anyone else is doing it? So they did that, and they got all the buzzed, and so, you know, that's why you got so successful.
Yeah, and that's another really good point about trying to essentially fit a square peg into a round hole with moving games or genres from one market to another. And you really can't apply the same thoughts of physical to the digital market and vice versa. I mean, we could use this as a parallel to a lot of what's going on with like movies these days, with like trying to get like comic book adaptations, and the ones that are working right are the ones that are trying to change it to fit the market rather than trying to force the market, force one market to be like another one.
Yeah, exactly.
And I do want to, before I forget, taking this back to mobile and what you were saying a few minutes ago regarding trying to copy the big guys, you know, chase the ones who have already made that money. We're seeing that same problem with a lot of indie developers trying to enter the mobile space to be like the next Zynga or the next King or whatever, that these companies are so well established because of their name and their brand, that if you're trying to copy them, you're always going to be in their shadow. If someone types in, let's say, Clash of Clans, they're going to pull up everything Clash of Clans related. They're not going to find your game that may copy those elements, you know, 80 points or 80 lists down the line on a search engine. So it becomes that much harder to try and make a name for yourself when you're trying, again, to chase after someone that's already been well-established, someone with, you know, the marketing brand and the, you know, the money and the clout to be at the top of everyone's, you know, most search lists.
Yeah, exactly. I think for indies, it's just my opinion, the best way to succeed is by being different. You know, make a game that's different. But there are a lot of like different games, like weird games. Yes. You know, but I guess the key for success is it has to be different and fun.
Yeah.
If it's different, if it's just a different, it's not going to be popular, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So you make something different and you test it, and if it's fun, then go for it. But if it's not fun, maybe, I mean, if you're someone who's just happy with just a few users, you know, that's okay. But like, I guess all the game developers, they want some kind of success, you know. So you have to also focus on like making it fun, you know.
Yeah. And that's another really good point, something that I've been seeing a lot, especially with looking at more indie games over the like last few years with Game Wisdom, that there's definitely that point where sometimes a game is just too unique for its own good. When something that's, you know, impossible to break into, it's something that only a small group of people actually be able to understand or figure out, and for everyone else, it's just very frustrating to play. Like, in a post I made like a few weeks ago, I basically said like one of like the biggest tells of a novice game designer is when they make a incredibly archaic and hard to control UI for their game. Something that it doesn't feel right in the person's hand, it's confusing to look at. And again, a lot of what goes into making a really popular game, or I'm sorry, a really successful game, is being able to do that refinement and that fine-tunement to make it something that people can look at and go, okay, I see what this is. This looks great. Let me try it out. If your game is so incomprehensible and someone just looks at it for 5 seconds and go, I don't want to play this, then it doesn't matter how great your game is once you've learned after like 5-6 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I guess that's why you need a lot of like beta testing, and also you should attend a lot of game shows. And speaking of game show, like it's really difficult for us to attend like big game shows like PAX or GDC because of the location, you know. Yeah. So we're a small studio, so it's hard for us to afford, you know, like travel expenses. So yeah. I guess this this advantage we have being in an indie studio in Korea, and all the indie studios in Korea, they have same problem. I think I guess biggest problem for them is the language, because they don't speak English, you know. Mm-hmm. And I guess the best chance for them to succeed is on Steam. But if you don't speak English, you know, it's very hard to be successful on Steam, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see, there are so many good games, I mean, in Korea too, you know, very unique games. But it's really, sometimes it's sad to see them not very, not well known in the West, because they don't speak English, you know. So for fake dice, that's why they have a guy like me, you know. So
yeah, and I understand about the limitations of location too. I can't get around to most conventions, one, because of the cost, and two, because of I'm limited mobility wise because of my right leg. I can't really drive a car. So I'm sort of stuck in places as well. It's one of like the good things about like the internet these days, just being able to contact people electronically rather than going there. But it is getting more and more important, for, especially in these studios, to make a good showing at these conventions too.
Right, right. We attended this small Korean like indie game show, and it was a really good experience. You know, like you can get the users' feedback right there. You know, so you can hear what's good or bad about your game. So it's good to attend those shows. But if you can't, I guess it doesn't really affect that much. But it's always good to like get attend those shows, I guess. Yeah, there's nothing to lose, I guess.
I think with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about Diceny, and then I think that will probably take us to the end of today's cast.
Okay.
So we've been talking on and off about the game. We've talked a little bit about like how the original concepts for it came about, but for people who haven't heard of it before, Mike, could you, I guess, give like sort of like the elevator pitch, or like what is Diceny about?
Okay, so the best way to put it is Hearthstone meets Monopoly, plus maybe a RPG story setting combined with a lot of puns and parodies. That's the best way to put it. Yeah.
Okay. And we talked a little bit about the Kickstarter and how you guys went from there. How has the game, like, really, like, has the game at all changed as you've gone through, like, the different models from Kickstarter to early access to where it is right now? I guess further into the early access period.
Yes, definitely. Like, when we launched our Kickstarter, we were aiming to develop it as a multiplayer game. It's still not out of question, but we were hoping to generate the money that would allow us to add, you know, multiplayer feature. But when we found a publisher, we did. But we're developing it for mobile, and the publisher left, so we had to give them back or the a license fee. So right now we don't have the resource to develop it for multiplayer. So right now we're focused on single player. So that's why we try to add, you know, just interesting storylines and all those stages. Yeah. So that's the biggest difference, I guess.
Okay. Now, it's interesting about talking about the comparison of Hearthstone meets Monopoly. Because you're combining the CCG aspect of deck building with the randomness of board games and dice-influenced design as well. Could you talk a little bit more about how you guys sort of approach balancing or combining these two usually separate genres?
I guess, but in my opinion, it's not very rare to see like board games combined with the cards. You know, you see tons of board games using cards, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that, I guess, unique, but like we were, you know, as I said, we got this idea for a roguelike game, and we just our approach is just you know, if you just mixing up, but after mixing some stuff, and see where it will take us. That's pretty much our approach, and we were like, oh, on the board, maybe we add a card elements, kind of like Hearthstone. And so that's where the game, you know, how it became the where we are right now. And even now, we don't know. We still haven't found that right balance. So I guess we just have to, you know, adding stuff or, you know, tweaking the already existing stuff, see where it takes us, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, for people listening to the cast, in terms of, like, content in Dicini right now, what is currently available in the game for someone to play if they go on Steam right now and pick it up?
You can expect, I think we have, like, six stages right now. And should I explain how to play the game? Or?
Yeah, that would be good.
So basically, there's a board, and your hero and the enemy hero, and you roll around the board and try to reducing the enemy's HP to zero, and you can do that by using your card deck, consisting of 20. Right now it's 15, but in the next update we're going to make it to 20.
Okay.
And you can have up to five cards in your hand, and the cards consist of minion cards. You can place them on the board, and spell cards is like maybe like a direct damage. It could be direct damage, or like it can move you to a certain spot. So by doing that, you try to reduce the enemy's HP to zero, and on the board there are many like obstacles, or if you get lucky, there's items hidden, or some space will heal you up, you know. So there are many like random spaces on the board. So with all those elements, you try to beat your enemy. And enemies is not just like one versus one style. It could be like a big giant boss, or the enemies could be two, or your stage objective could be like maybe rescue these people, villagers, or something. And depending on the stage, there's like specific game objective. Yeah, so that's Dicini.
Okay. And from what I play, you can choose different classes at the start. What makes each class like different? Like, how does class design work in the game?
So it's very similar to other role-playing games, like Dungeons and Dragons, you know. Warrior, rogue, mage and cleric. Yeah, so warrior is kind of like a head on. You attack head on. So he has a lot of like movement based cards. You know, move to certain spot. Mage is like she attacks with the spells. You know, and rogue, you kind of try to command. You know, your minions. And cleric, he can heal. So each class they have like a hero skill. I guess kind of like a Hearthstone. You know, you have a hero skill, right? It's similar to that. So they have unique skills, and also there's one net bonus, which is you get when you makes a full circle on the board, and they all have like different. One net bonus. Warrior, for example, he gets like attack or armor and certain yeah, so they all have different one net bonus, and they have different stat or as well, like some has more HP and some has more mana. So yeah, that's how they're different.
Now, with the actual like CCG side of Destiny, you're building the deck, and as you said, right now the limit is 15, which you're planning on raising to 20 the next update.
Yes.
And right there, that's an actually a really good point I want to ask you about, Mike, and that is figuring out the limit of your deck. This is one of those things that is very important for any CCG game. There's always that sense of, you know, what's the right number for my game? Like, you always feel like, when, especially with like Hearthstone, trying to build a deck, like, you could always use just that one more card that you need to make your deck perfect. So, for you guys, and with the design of Destiny, how did you decide to raise your limit to 20? And do you think that's going to be like the hard limit from this point going forward?
Probably not, because the how we got to 15 was we did a lot of like offline with the real board. You know, we did a lot of testing, or what do you call that?
Paper prototype.
Prototype testing with the real paperboard, and that's how we got to 15. Oh, we did a maybe start from 10. Maybe we need more cars. So we did maybe raising one by one, and we got to 15, and we were like, oh, maybe it will work. And then we released our game on Steam, and after we got a lot of feedback from users that maybe 15 is not enough, and we also could also see that because most of the times like they would run out of cars, and some of the classes there's one of the classes. His special skill is actually draw a card, and like every turn, if you draw a card, you sooner or later run out of it. So anyway, the number was too few, and it was all based on mainly based on user feedback. So oh, maybe we should we don't have like a like good mechanic for it, but we were like, oh, maybe 20 will work, and we tested it, and it's a lot better than 15. So yeah, that's how we got to 15, and in our next after our next update, if we get a lot of user feedback saying, oh, maybe it's too few, we need more, then maybe we will consider again.
Now, moving on, focusing more on the cards now. As you said, there's different types of cards in Destiny. You have like the minions who you can place on the board. You have spell cards. You have cards that can do a wide variety of abilities. In terms of like design and balancing side of things, how did you and your team come up with like how you wanted the cards to be or control playing a match of Destiny?
So the question is how we came up with the cars?
Yeah, like the balance of the cards or what you wanted the cards to like do in the game.
So it's a board game, so we definitely needed some kind of movement cards, like you move one step forward, or like you move to a certain whatever the space you want, you know. And we the other cards we actually took reference from a lot of other card games, you know. That's something I guess you cannot do from the scratch. You know, I guess you have to took some reference, and we just tested, and we just thought, oh, maybe it would work for our game, and we tested it worked. Then we would add. So that's how we got all the cards, and I guess yeah, that's how we did it. Yeah.
So in terms of like the actual like I guess like balance of like designing these cards, because one of the challenges of making a game like Dyson is the fact that you have both the randomness of what cards you draw as well as the randomness of the board itself. In terms of like along those lines, were there any like card ideas or card concepts that you guys came up with that were considered like too overpowered or would I guess like ruin the flow of the game?
Let me think. There are definitely overpowered cards. Let me just, could you give me a second? I cannot
Yeah,
think of it right now.
fair.
There's a cars oh that deals like okay so there are some like unbalanced cars like they cost the same. There are two cars and they cost the same, but the other one has a like bigger attack point, so something like that we should definitely add it. Also there's like a card called Braveheart. It's if you use it, you don't die in your current turn. So I think that's kind of overpowered, you know. I guess that's all. I mean, if I prepare for this, like I would probably name more, but that's all I can think of right now. Yeah, and so, sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah, not a problem. Now, with the Dyson-y, I think one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Mike, would have to be like the art style. It has like a very interesting aesthetic to it, a very distinctive aesthetic too. How did you guys settle on like the art for the game?
Our approach was we tried to make it as Western as possible. We didn't want people to think, oh, this is Korean game, you know. I don't know. What do you think? It's does it look like maybe Asian game or what do you think?
I would say no. It looks. I don't know. Like, I'm not. I don't think I'm of the right opinion to say whether what country it looks from. But it looks like something different. Like, it doesn't look like. I would say like when I see a lot of games that are considered like from the Korean market, it's like a very hyper like stylized, like very cartoon look to them. Like you can sometimes tell like with like how like the 3D models look. With Dyson-y, I don't see that. It looks more comic book or more I guess like pulp. I'm not sure if that's like the right word to use to describe it.
So I guess that's what yeah you just mentioned what you just mentioned. That's our focus, you know, trying to make it as cartoonish as possible, and we wanted to put also a lot of parodies, as you can see, like the main character guys, obviously parody of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Conan the Barbarian, you know. So we wanted to make it fun, funny, and also as Western as possible. Like Koreans indie developers, they say, oh, they didn't know our game was made by a Korean game. They said, oh, we thought it was just Western game, and that's some the reaction we wanted. And also our artist, he's a big fan of like American like anime, cartoon, like DC Comics or Marvel. So his influence was definitely reflected in the art, and we also got reference from we were definitely influenced by other like indie games. We looked Darkest Dungeon was one of the games we kind of looked at. Oh, which looks so cool, you know. I guess it kind of influenced us and other indie games. Yeah, so it's kind of a combination of all the influences.
All right, cool. So here's one question that I wanted to ask you about regarding like the balance and design of the game. And this is one of the things that I was noticing during my time spent playing a little bit of Destiny like a few days ago. And one of like the hardest things to do with games built around randomization, this goes back to my post on CCG elements and design, is the fact that a lot of what determines whether or not the player is going to win is out of their hands. It's left to the mercy of the a random number generator. In a traditional card game, it basically you just have to worry about your deck and the opponent's deck and who draws what. But with a game like Destiny, you also have the added impact of the board. Not only do you have to worry about what cards you draw, but also what happens if you get nothing but like twos and threes while your opponent gets like huge numbers and goes around the board quicker. So my question for you is, how is you and the rest of your team approaching, I guess, figuring out like the middle ground or the happy medium between the randomization from the deck side of things and the randomization of the board game and dice rolling side of things?
I guess oh man, I wish our game designer was here because he's the main guy who comes up with all the game design. So I guess from what I've seen, the way he works is he tests he comes up with a different board designs, and he just tests it like with on the engine, and if it works, then we just apply it. And right now, like some of the early stages, sometimes they're more difficult than the later stages. It's not very balanced, so that's something we have to work on, I guess. I guess testing is the best way to balance that. You just try it, and if it works, then you just apply it.
I guess another question I want to ask you about, and this will probably start segueing into like the final parts of the cast for tonight. In terms of the future of Destiny, do you see you and your team adding in more cards? Like actually like designing and playing new cards, or are the cards in the game like it for right now?
I think we're definitely adding more cards. Right now we don't have enough cards, to be honest. It's I read it somewhere like if you add too many cards, it's not good for your game because it will raise the barrier for the new users. But right now we're nowhere near where we hope it should be. Like there are too few, so I think we should have at least like double what we have right now. So we keep adding, and I guess we wouldn't even add that many if we even if we wanted to because of the limited resources. So we definitely need to add more cards.
And that's another part, again, that's very tricky, as you just said, Mike, regarding if you have too many cards, it just bogs the game down. Like, you look at a game, like, if you start a game for the first time, you see there's, like, I can build my deck out, like, 500 cards. It's like, what the hell am I supposed to do? I think that was another good thing with Hearthstone. It launched with a very lean selection of cards, at least lean compared to other CCGs at the time. Now, of course, they've been adding in more cards with each new expansion, but they do give the player, like at the start, a good idea or a good starter deck, something so they can start understanding the basics and then, grow out from there. And I would say one other good thing about Hearthstone is that a lot of their cards, in terms of like rarity, are not necessarily always like the best choice. A lot of their more advanced cards are limited to the legendary and higher classes because they're a lot more complicated to use. So it's not like someone starting brand new is going to be immediately wiped out, but you still there's still that allure of those better cards, the fancier graphics and new abilities and stuff to keep someone motivated to play.
If you go to like Hearthstone Arena, the good players they always win, like no matter what cards they get. So that's something Hearthstone did really well, like there's a randomness about if you have good skill, you will win. So yeah, they did a really good job on that. Yeah.
So far, it's been a great time talking with you, Mike.
Thank
So
you.
to, yeah, not a problem. So to start to wrap things up and I guess move things forward with Dyson-E, one question that I did want to ask you about. Now, with Dyson-E, is this your studio's first time on early access on Steam?
Actually, no. The previous game I mentioned, it was on early access actually
Okay.
for a long time. Yeah.
Okay. I guess my question for you then is, with Dyson-E and with like your experience on early access, how are you guys finding the platform like as an independent studio?
The reason we decided to go with early access was first we wanted the user feedback, and second it was for our financial. We needed some money, you know.
Yeah.
At the time we were kind of in trouble, so yeah, we needed some kind of income. So those are the two reasons. And like 2 years ago, early access was like a big thing, you know. Everyone was doing it, and now it doesn't have a very good reputation, you know. Just people don't buy your game just for the fact that your game is on early access. Like many of the people, they just follow it and oh, see where it goes, and then when it comes out, maybe I will consider buying it. So that's how their attitude. But for us, like we didn't have much choice, to be honest. Like we didn't do many beta, so we needed some kind of like testings. So early access was exactly for that. But and we needed some money, so you know, early access you can make money out of the, just bring your game on the market. So I'm sure a lot of people are not happy about that, you know, like getting money for the incomplete game. But it's yeah, for us we didn't have many choices, you know. And I don't know, like whether this is a good move or not. Only time will tell. Sometimes like your game, you know, early access people look at it and it doesn't look good, and they completely lose interest in the game. So I guess only time will tell. And but I've seen some games who've improved during early access. That get successful in the full launch. So that's what we're hoping.
Yeah. And again, like I think you made a really good point a few seconds ago, Mike, regarding the state of early access now compared to where it was like 2 years ago. It's the same thing we see with Kickstarter. At the start of the Kickstarter boom, pretty much you could go on the platform saying, "I have an idea, give me money." That's pretty much all you need. Today, you need a lot more work. I know recently, John Romero, who was one of the main developers on like Doom, put up a Kickstarter for his like dream first-person shooter idea, and then he took it down because he realized that people want to see like a gameplay demo. And like with early access, people also are judging it a lot more. They expect more out of an early access build than they did before. Like unless you really have the clout or a big name behind you, your first build in early access has to be, you know, somewhat reasonably there. Like people don't expect, you know, the whole game, but they want more than just like a lot of early access games are just like you can move a character around and pick up a block. That's the entire game. Give me $5. That's not gonna work today.
Yeah, exactly. And like also even Valve mentions it in their policy, like or something, like if you're considering to release your game on early access, consider it as like full release, you know, because go ahead.
Oh, I was just about to say that is a really good point. Something I'm hearing from a lot of developers as well when they talk about early access is that very same idea that when you put your game on early access, this is the version people are going to see that's representative of your title. So if you put a bad version of the game out, it's basically launching your game with like half its features missing. And then not only do you mess up that, but then you mess up possibly months of time that people are going to be downloading your game and, you know, not liking it from there.
Right. It's a, I guess that the Darkest Dungeon did a really good job. Like, I from what I heard, like they did like update like almost every week, and the game was already good when it came out on Early Access. So I guess we were hoping for a similar thing, but we are not updating it as often as we should. It's like I want to update, but you know, we have six people and we have our different opinions, and you know, the relationship between the community guy and the developers, you know, we should, I always tell them we should do more updates, and they say, oh, it's not as easy as that, you know, like whenever we do update, we have to worry about bugs, you know, and so it's not, updating is as, it's not as easy as it seems.
Definitely, and that's something I've spoken to a lot of indie developers about the last few years. Another indie company, Rage Squid, who did the game Action Hank a few, I think it was, it came out either last year or the year before that. When they originally got on Early Access, they were doing once a week updates to their game, and it was basically killing them, because as your developers obviously know, for each new version you release, you then also have to patch that version, fix any bugs with it, and then you're basically working on that instead of working on the overall progress of the game. But at the same time, if you go months and months and months without any updates, people are going to start wondering, why isn't this game being updated? Did the developers just, you know, cut and run? You know, this game's not worth my time, and the developers aren't updating it. So you also need to be able to get on to a plan or an update plan that works for you, and then you have to stick to it. I know with like another indie studio, Gaslamp Games, they adhere to about once a month for their updates. It was the same thing with Introversion Software and Prison Architect. They said, we're going to update this game once a month, you know, barring any big emergencies or family issues, and they kept to it. And people knew, like, they could get excited at the end of each month or the start of the next, because they know, okay, there's a new update for the game coming out, I'm excited. So I think part of the challenge, especially for smaller studios such as you guys, is you have to get to, you have to get to a cycle that you're comfortable with patching and putting it out, and then you have to stick to that and then inform your community about it.
Yeah, I actually know this one Korean indie developer, and I actually wrote a Gamastra article. It was my first article, and it's about how he got his Steam review score is like 94%, and I asked him what are the secrets, and he said he did update like even like every day, like even twice a day, and he said he basically had no life. That's like consequence he had to go through, and like in a way, like I think it was easier for him to do that updates that often, because it was a one man studio. But we have six people, and we have different opinions. So, in a way, that's, I mean, people would assume that since we have more people, it would be easier for us to work, you know, do more stuff. But sometimes it doesn't work that way, because you have to make decisions, and in a way, I kind of think of, you know, the kind of frequent updates more easier for one-man studio, in my opinion.
You know, especially when you have complete control of the project, when you're able to do basically the whole work yourself. Like, if there's a problem, you're the guy who's going to fix it, the same guy who's also going to patch it out and do everything. But when you're a bigger studio, and again, you have different people handling different parts of it, if one guy decides to release a patch early and doesn't tell, you know, the next guy, if that patch breaks, then there's more work on him, and you just run into that trouble. And that's why it's so important, especially when you're trying to market your game on Early Access, to pick a schedule that works best for you. And then once you got that set, you have to adhere to it. A case in point of a studio that didn't do that was Double Fine. When they did the Early Access game Space Base DF9, they originally promised like it was like once a month for updates. Then they went like 2 months without an update. Then they did no updates for 6 months, and everyone was wondering, you know, what the hell is going on with this game? And then people just got tired of waiting, and the game just took such a hit that they couldn't recover. And basically, it's probably like one of the biggest like red marks on Double Fine's record for a very long time.
Right. I guess you have to be really careful whenever you make some kind of promises. Mm-hmm. I'm community manager, so sometimes like I want to, when a user has a question, I want to answer right there. But oh man, can we do this? Sometimes I go, can we do this? You know, so sometimes I left it don't answer some questions. Because I don't want to like make some promises that I don't know whether we'll make or not, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's one of the tricky things being a community manager, I think.
Yeah, and it's always that challenge again when you're like the quote unquote face of the company for the consumers. They're the ones who are going to come to you if there's any questions or they have any problems, and then it's up to you to try to answer those questions.
Yeah. I mean, I got a lot used to it, but before, like, when I first started, it's like, I think, like, board game gamers, I think, are more mature than the users from other genres, just from what I've seen. So before, it was multiplayer fighting game. And I was like, every time I looked at the community hub, it's like a full of curses, whatever, you know. So it's a really frustrating experience, but thanks to that I got more since users did so bad, you know, it actually gave me a very good experience. So I got a lot used to it now. So yeah,
cool. All right, I think with that we can probably start to wrap things up. I guess for you, Mike, I just have a few general questions regarding Destiny, and then we will say goodnight.
Okay, sounds good.
Alright, so I guess my first question then, for people listening to the cast who are interested in the game, do you have any like current time frame or schedule for when the game will be done, or is that still too much up in the air at the moment?
We may do some kind of like a beta type update in May, like late May, but we're aiming for early July or late June for official launch. Yeah.
Okay. So now, in terms of the pricing, I was looking at the store page. Is the game? I know you guys said that you're going to raise the price up as more content gets added. Is the price going to change any more between now and your hopeful launch?
That's something we haven't made a decision yet. Sorry. Because before it was $5, and to be honest, our sales was better back then than now. After we raised the price, so we didn't put much thought into that when we changed the price. So this time around, we want to take some time to think about it, because raising like the price, maybe our game is not worth it. I mean for us it's worth it, but like to users, maybe it's less than that. So we want to put more thought into it. So whether it's going to be raised or not, it's I cannot answer that right now. Okay. Yeah.
No problem. All right. I guess another question then for you, regarding like the future of Destiny. Do you see, like, after the game is hopefully released in like the next month or so, do you see yourselves like continuing to work on the game or moving to like another project?
To be really honest, it all depends on how the game does. Right now, to be really honest, it's not enough to feed all the staff. So our full launch should definitely do well for us. Okay. It's our main focus. So it all depends. That's how being an indie developer, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I can say right now.
Okay.
I definitely hope to continue it, but I mean, who knows?
All right. Yep, I gotcha. And yeah, it's definitely very challenging to be an independent developer, and that's probably a topic we could spend like the next hour or so talking about. All right. So I think with that, I think I'm about just about ready to wrap things up. Mike, were there any parts of Dyson-E that I miss that you would like to like bring up or mention before we say goodnight?
I would say a lot of people like want multiplayer, but we want multiplayer too. Like actually, we want multiplayer more than probably the most more than anyone. But we just don't have resources. But I guess it depends on how the game does. We really want to see it, and we will do our best to make it happen. Anyway, so. So for those of you who don't know Destiny, so if you like a board game and like a card game like Hearthstone, and if you want enjoy like parodies and just fun jokes, then that's the you should give it a try. So yeah, so that's all I want to say.
Okay, cool. That also answers my other question, if you had any final thoughts you would like to say too. Okay, I think with that, we're going to end things here. Mike, it was a pleasure talking to you today on the Perceptive Podcast. I know I'm recording it at night where I am, and I know it's like early morning in South Korea for you.
I usually come to work like 11, so we're indie, so we kind of start late. But today I ca came 9 a.m., so I was kind of sleepy. But it was actually I felt good, looking at all those other commuters, in the subway. It's actually it felt good, so it was a good experience.
Cool. All right. So, Mike, it was definitely great talking with you today. I wish you guys the best of luck with Dyson-E. Hopefully, I can have you back on in like a few months, and we can talk more about how well Dyson-E did.
Thank you. Thank you for giving this opportunity. I had a lot of fun, so I wish you all the luck. So I will follow you on your podcast. So good luck, and thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yep, not a problem. For those of you listening, by the time this cast goes up, my video spotlight of Dyson-E should be up on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. There should be a link to that in the podcast notes below. So, with all that said, we're going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options available. First, if you'd like to be a guest for a future podcast or submit a guest piece to the site, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. For podcast guests, I'm always looking for new people, be them students, enthusiasts, members of the industry, whoever. If you'd like to talk design, definitely shoot me an email. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom through our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking that little Patreon banner on the front page. Any donations would be greatly appreciated. They'll allow me to keep the site ad-free and allow me to keep putting out great content like this. To get the latest updates when new content goes live, subscribe on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. And last but not least, be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel with an ever-growing list of Let's Plays, video reviews, and more great content. You can find me on YouTube under Game Wisdom, and there's also the little link on the front page. So, thanks again, Mike, for coming on, and hopefully I can have you back on again real soon with more updates on Dyson-E.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. So again, for those of you listening, thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you have a great rest of the week, and I will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.